Please proceed.
May it please the court, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. I'm Richard Stevens. I represent Mr. Ringhoffer, the appellant in this action. I think the pivotal question in this case is the interplay of a couple of court rules, a statute, and the open courts provision of the state constitution. And the question is whether or not the statute or the rule prohibits people from access to court records regarding prospective jurors. That's correct.
If we were talking about court closure, and we were talking about Article 1, Section 10, it's the same provision, but opposite. Instead of something that's closed being open, or provided we've got something that's open, the court going off is being closed. If we're talking about court closure, we would apply the Bone Club test. And the first step to that would be notice to the actual parties to the litigation, and notice to affected parties with an opportunity to be heard. That's the first thing that a trial judge does when confronted with a closure question, the first requirement of the law. Did those other counties provide these documents without notice to the persons who submitted them, having been told that the legislature viewed them as being privileged?
I don't know the answer to that directly, but I believe that that is true. I believe that the documents...
Should that happen?
Well, Your Honor, I think it should. And part of the reason...
So the legislature passes a privilege statute that says something is not going to be used for any other purpose or disclosed to anybody. Citizens are told that that's the law, and then some non-elected functionary of the government should then ignore the legislature, ignore the promise made to the citizen, and give that information to someone else without telling the citizen that they did it. That's how this is supposed to work.
Well, Your Honor, I think the problem is in the interpretation of the statute, because the statute says that these documents are not supposed to be used for any other term, because obviously the situations change. People may not be eligible to serve on juries, and that may change. And the second thing it said was they're not to be used for any other purpose. The legislature did not say they cannot be disclosed to other people. I mean, that has been the assumption in this case, but that is not what the statute says. And I think that the statute should be interpreted in light of both the common law right of access and as well as the constitutional provision involving open courts. The court rule, GR 18D, mimics and says exactly the same thing. That issue had not come up, and if that is a requirement, then that's not the facts in this case, Your Honor. We believe we're entitled to it, and if the court decides to give notice, and if the court should give notice, and those people have an opportunity to request the disclosure not happen, and maybe that should happen, but it should not.
Should it happen after the fact, after these people have already come through the jury pool, or should it happen before they start having any communications with the court about their professed ineligibility to serve?
Well, I think that's really, a decision for the court to make, on the court to find out what is the easiest, the best administration of this program.
Fairest,
perhaps?
It's. Notice usually goes to fairness to the person involved, does it not?
Right.
Not to administrative convenience, first and foremost.
But I think the court could decide, are we going to give people notice in advance before you put in your information? Or they could provide the information to those people later and say, somebody has requested disclosure of this information. I think that could go either way. I think the court, it solves that problem. And I think that's best solved by the court. I think it is important to realize that the legislature did not say we are banning public disclosure or that we are closing off this. They said, court, don't use it for other other purposes. Don't use it for bench warrants, for instance. Don't use it for other things, and use it only for the particular term. But did not say the public is not entitled to this at all. Also, I think it's important to look at the respondent's argument that this is not even a court record. And I think it's important to look at the language in General Rule 31, which says court record includes but is not limited to. It's a pretty broad definition. And the fact that these documents are not used for a particular court proceeding does not mean they're not a court record. They're maintained by the court. They're kept by the court. They are, in fact, a court record. And if the court is to decide that for some reason the public...
Administrative records of the court are also maintained by the court and kept by the court. So that begs the question of what a document is. And that may be answered by the proposed rule, Gen 31, whatever it is.
The rule does talk about administrative records, yes, just like it talks about judges' notes.
And the question is whether that makes a distinction or not. So, you know, it may well be somewhat inartfully drafted at this point, and I'll confess it probably is, but given where this has all gone. But it still seems to me the statute and the intent of the legislature is very clear. And not only that, it is consistent throughout all of the Supreme Court's enactments with regard to this and pronouncements that this applies, albeit perhaps not in the face of a constitutional challenge, only where the legislature or some other rule has not prohibited disclosure. And that's what we have here, really. What was the intent of the legislature with regard to this statute? I can assure you I know what the intent of the clerks was with regard to this statute. And it isn't as you are advocating.
That may be.
You have your rebuttal time remaining.
If I could just could I take 1 minute of that time?
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think one of the problems in assuming that because the record is not part of a particular court proceeding, therefore it is not a court record, that would mean that people would not be entitled to any records regarding how the court generates the larger pool. I think people do have the right to know, is the court getting selecting from a larger pool of people? And you can't just say, well, it's not in relation to a particular court proceeding, therefore it's not a court record. So I think there's not only the broader language, there's also and the court's interpretation of the open courts provision, there is also the problem with isolating how the court selects jurors, which would be on review of the public.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. For the record, my name is Tom Cuffell. I'm a deputy prosecuting attorney representing the respondent, Linda Ridge, in this case. I'd like to start off by addressing the constitutional issues first, sort of taking my arguments in reverse order as they were laid out in the brief. I think our position is that on the Constitution is that the law draws a distinction. It draws a distinction between one's qualification to be a juror in general, and one's fitness or suitability to serve as a juror in a particular case. We think in the latter instance, it's clear that those are critical stages in the criminal trial, and they're critical stages for good reasons. The judge has a role in that context in ensuring that the defendant is given the opportunity to have a fair and impartial jury selected. The defendant has a role in that situation because it's one of the first opportunities to defend him or herself in the proceeding. Yes, Your Honor.
Can you make sense of the Casey decision as applied to this dispute?
I think that this case is like the Casey decision in this way. I think the trigger in the Casey decision, in my view, the issue was, what's going to trigger the constitutional Ishikawa analysis? And I think the holding in the Casey decision was that if you have a situation that is not part of, that's outside the court, a deposition, mere discovery, it's not introduced into the record, it's not part of a motion, it's not part of a hearing, that is something that is sort of outside the circle that isn't going to trigger the requirement under Article 1, Section 10 and the First Amendment that the court go through an Ishikawa analysis to determine not whether someone gets access to that or not. I think this case is like that because essentially we're taking the same position. And that position is when it comes to the preliminary determination as to whether or not someone can be a juror in general, that situation is what we have here. That does not trigger the obligation of anyone to go through an Ishikawa analysis because the Constitution simply isn't implicated at that stage in the process.
Well, it seems to me that's a pretty bold statement on your part, Mr. Cowell, given the concern of many courts, including the United States Supreme Court, with the veneer, not just the selection from the veneer, but the selection of it. In other words, the assemble of those. And indeed, since the creation of the state of Washington, that's probably been the subject of more cases than cases with regard to challenges to individual jurors, and that is where and how did the sheriff, it was the sheriff at one point at the direction of the clerk, bring these people to the veneer, and is the veneer fairly selected, and are they peers or not, and should they come from the eastern part of the county or the southern part of the county? All of those issues and all have been approached from the standpoint as being part and parcel of the jury selection. As it then comes into focus, I agree with you, the focus changes in the front of an individual judge as distinct from overall supervision. I don't know if we get very far with that. I think perhaps an opposing counsel touched on this in terms of what is a definition of proceeding might be. I appreciate the distinction, however. I just don't know how far we could take it.
Your office worked on a case that went to the state Supreme Court where the process of assigning jurors to Kent from south of I-90 and jurors to Seattle from north of I-90 was challenged. Is it your position that you could have kept away from that lawsuit information of the type that's requested in this instance under the same argument that you're making now?
Well, I am half remembering the case, so I will caveat my answer by saying it may only be half right. But I think that the issue in that case was whether or not one is entitled to a jury of the county under Article 1, Section 22. And so the question was, does that mean it's a jury, can you administratively divide up the county between north and south? And I think at least as far as that case was concerned, the court interpreted the phrase jury of the county to not be contrary.
Talk about the legal theories. I'm talking about the evidence. Presumably someone took steps to prove that the King County Superior Court was not bringing people from the whole county to both Kent and to Seattle, but rather had divided them. And maybe somebody just admitted that that was true. But assuming that it wasn't admitted that it was true, and so someone actually wanted to get the data to prove it, are you saying that they would not be able to? That state constitutional claim could be frustrated because they wouldn't be able to get that data based on the same argument that you're making here?
I think the answer to that is no, but I don't think it's necessarily inconsistent with the position that we're taking here.
And the next paragraph that you utter is important.
Well, that's why I said I'm only half remembering the case. So I think that certainly in the course of discovery in a case, one can utilize the discovery rules to get information from a government entity, from the court, that would provide data that would shed light on that issue and maybe take that and have that answer.
A right granted by court rule would get you there, but a right granted by the state constitution would not?
I think in this situation, I think the answer to that has to be yes. And I think that that's not inconsistent.
Well, it has to be yes for you to be right. But the question is, can it be yes?
I think it can be yes. And I think that you don't have the same context in this situation that you do there. I mean, I think it's perfectly appropriate for someone through the course of discovery to utilize the subpoena power to get information. We don't have that here. And in the absence of that, what we have is a couple of court rules and a statute. And I think our position is that both the court rules and the statute are pretty clear. The information, I think that they are consistent with our theory of the case, that there is a distinction for constitutional purposes and for interpretation of those statutory purposes, as well as the court rule, between the fitness and suitability to serve as a juror in a specific case and what we think is purely an administrative process. And it has to be an administrative process because...
I'm just bewildered by the assertion that that a lawyer signing a subpoena has a greater right to obtain information than a citizen armed with a copy of the state constitution that says, this means me. I just don't know how you get there, because where does the power to sign the subpoena comes from? It only comes from a statute. It doesn't come from the constitution. So how can you possibly be right on the argument you're making right now?
Well, I mean, the other way you get there, I think, is you look at GR 31. And GR 31 presumes access, so even under that scenario, assuming for your point, there is access that can be gathered under the rule also carves out an exception. And the exception is if there is a statute, if there is a court rule that says otherwise. And so, I mean, we make the point, you know, sort of systematically working through the rule, that this isn't a court record, but even assuming for our sake here that it is, there is still both an exception in GR 18 as well as an exception in RCW 2.360724 that says they don't get...
And then your opponent counsel will say, well, that's fine, you can have a court rule, but my Article 1, Section 10 claim trumps your court rule. So how does the court rule serve to trump the constitutional claim?
I don't think there's a conflict. I mean, obviously a court rule or a statute can't trump the Constitution, but our position is, like in Casey, the Constitution simply isn't implicated at this point in time, because in this administrative process, you simply don't have the same attributes at play that you do when someone is going through jury selection, actual jury selection in a case. You don't have anyone exercising discretion. The judge doesn't exercise discretion. Defense counsel doesn't exercise discretion. The prosecutor doesn't exercise discretion. In fact, we think they sort of characterized it right in the first place when they called it non-juror data, because by definition, someone who checks a box on the form and sends it in can't be a juror in the first place. So we think there is. We think the line is real. We think the line has support in the law. And I'll just add in my last couple of seconds,
second. I apologize to counsel. I had not realized that this was a 15-minute per side case. So I cut Mr. Stevens off when he had only gone for 8 minutes, and I had set this to end when you had used 10. If you would like to use 5 more, you may, and then I'm going to accord Mr. Stevens his full amount of time.
I would like to use... I'd like to use 5 minutes, and we'll see how it goes.
All right, that's fine.
I reserve the right to walk away early.
I think that's a good reservation.
Okay. Always a good
reservation. Sorry to interrupt the structure of your argument.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, let me follow up on 2 points. One is there's some additional authority that I'll have to forward to the court under 10.8. It's State v. Irby, 170 Wash 2nd, 574. And really, that case, I would just point it up to the court's attention for the proposition that there, the issue was, if you're going to be excusing jurors via email, the Constitution still applies, and the defendant has a right to be there. In the court's analysis of that issue, they draw the distinction between general qualification to serve as a juror and what is going on in that case, which is we have information that's being elicited from this process. We have discretionary decisions that are being made by counsel. And so that's really why the court in that case rejected the, this is just an administrative process type of argument. This is like a sidebar. And so I think that case is instructive. It doesn't hold that there is a distinction, but it uses the distinction as the basis to formulate the conclusion of the case. It cites a Florida case, which stands for the proposition, so I'll have to follow up with that, but I wanted to bring that to the court's attention. I guess I would just like to finish by making a couple of points. We do think that the Constitution isn't triggered here for the reasons I've articulated. I think that the setting and the context matters for purposes of the Constitution, that when you're just talking about this preliminary determination that's set forth in the statute and the court rule, the context, the setting, the attributes of the proceeding are significantly different than they are in actual jury selection. And I guess the question, the concern that we would have is, if the court's going to start drawing the line to further up the road, where does it stop? I mean, does one have a constitutional right to go to DOL and say, we have a constitutional right to access the identicard information and the driver's license information? Do they have a constitutional right to go to the Secretary of State and says, we have a constitutional right to be present when you're
not under the open source provision? So we don't have to have too much angst about that. In terms of where this leads us, it's obviously we can't and won't decide this case based on a court rule that hasn't been adopted by the Supreme Court, but it has published 31.1 for comment.
Correct.
Are you familiar with that?
Yes.
Is that within the scope of what you do in your regular Monday through Friday work? Okay. Do you agree that this would fall within that these documents at issue here would fall within the definition of a court administrative record under 31.1?
Yes. That is our initial position in this case.
So we are dealing with a case here that has a shelf life of from now to whenever 31.1 gets passed.
Yes, although there is a definition of administrative records in GR 31 now.
Mm-hmm. Is it any
different
in the proposed rule?
I don't think it's substantively different, but I have to go back and check. I know that 31.1 will incorporate the same definition of court records that's currently in GR 31. And for what it's worth, I'm not saying these are chambers records. So that part of the new rule isn't going to have any impact on this case. Unless the panel has any other questions, I will conclude.
Would you like more?
I'm happy to, really.
I have one question. I suppose that the request came about for sort of the reverse reason. I mean, here what seems odd about it is that it's the person wanting the records is really not that interested in the operation of the courts so much as voting. A different question. It isn't going to a core function of the courts, purpose-wise. But suppose it was the other way. Suppose that there was some reason to believe that people were just deciding they didn't want to be part of juries. And they really were eligible, but they had realized that if they checked the box that said that they had been convicted of a felony or what any of the other things, they simply would be excluded from the list and they could escape from this task. And suppose somebody wanted to prove that was so because it was felt to be a problem of significant public import and needed to be corrected, since it would obviously have an impact on the fairness and representation of the veneer if that were a widespread problem. In that circumstance, would you think that people could obtain... And suppose they said, well, the court isn't doing anything about this. We've talked to the judges about this, but, you know, they don't believe it. And we want to prove that, you know, upstanding citizens who are completely crime-free are just willy-nilly checking these boxes.
My answer to that, Your Honor, is to adopt Senate Bill 5855. That's a legislative. I mean, the legislature is free to come in and change the statute. The Supreme Court is free to amend GR 18. You know, we're not here to debate sort of the wisdom of the underlying policy. I mean, I think Your Honor isn't even talking about a hypothetical. I think you're talking the actual facts of this case. You know, there is language in here about oversight of the judiciary. But the fact of the matter is they want this information for voter registration purposes. It's a policy decision. We're not here to say whether it's a good policy decision or a bad policy decision. But we are saying is that under the current state of the law, it's not permitted. And the legislature has had numerous opportunities to amend the law. The bill that we cited from 2011.
You have used your time. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you very much, Your Honor. Okay. Appreciate it.
And Mr. Stevens, I believe that you actually have, I guess
seven.
It's seven. Seven minutes left. And I apologize
I believe that's
to you
correct.
As well for interrupting your
I believe that's correct.
Organization.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to address a couple of these things that were mentioned earlier. One, the Casey case, I think the distinguishing feature about Casey that was that the deposition transcript was not a court record. It was never submitted to court. It's just that the deposition happened to occur within a courtroom. This is, it wasn't maintained by the
court. Well, it wasn't so much where it happened. It's that there was a judge there.
That's correct.
I mean, you could do a deposition in here, and if we're not sitting here, nobody's getting too excited.
And I've been in depositions where a judge has been on the phone, even though I've been in my office, in highly contentious depositions. But the point is,
That was the fault of the other party.
The point is, the court never had the record. I mean, it's not in its file anywhere. These are records kept in the files of the King County Superior Court.
Maybe not. I mean, they may not even be submitted. It's interesting in that the whole inquiry into how you publish a deposition and why it has to be open and published implicates all of this discussion, but coming at it from the other end. And that is, it does inform as to what the nature of a public record is, at least in view of the courts over the last 200 or 300 years, although depositions have morphed from one thing to another. I mean, it's a fascinating inquiry when one looks at it, and it actually did inform with regard to GR 31 and hopefully the drafters GR, the proposed amendments as well. So that brings me to my concern, and that is we're kind of skirting all around because they are predicate questions, but when you get to it, this information, it seems to me, at least certain aspects of it, were under compulsion. As a potential juror, I get the summons, there's compulsion. There's a statute that says I have to obey it. And part of it is it requires me to swear the negative, that I am not a felon, that I am not a resident, I guess, if you want to put it in a double negative. A number of things that to some people might be considered, and a reasonable person might consider some or all of that information offensive, apart from what we know isn't your name and a number of other things, although there are arguments being made about that as well. In other words, requiring me to disclose where I am and that I am, in fact, this person is viewed by some as objectionable and offensive because they have been victims of crimes and or domestic violence.
And I understand, Your Honor, and I think that that concern gets weighed against the open court's provision. I mean, that's the tough decision. But I think it's also important.
Who weighs it and when?
Yeah.
That's what I suggested earlier. I mean, if a person has a right to object to disclosure, the court can decide whether they're going to do it up front or they can do it when a request is made. That's the way Public Records Act requests come in. They usually give notice to parties who may have confidential information for an opportunity to object. That, I think, is an administrative decision.
But you say the distinction is that, I mean, that this is a court record because because why? I mean, the thing is that we know that people, at least I think this is the law, you can't just go down and file a document in a lawsuit and then say, well, see, it's in court now, so now everybody can have it.
That's coming up.
Well, it is coming up, yeah.
Well, I'm saying it's a court record.
But isn't, I mean, it seems to me that the arguably at least, the cases focus around the court, meaning the judicial function, meaning the information that goes through the mind of the judge and informs the judgment that is being exercised through the judicial power, through the power to affect people's lives that comes with the authority of being a judge. It doesn't come from a courtroom or from a location or from the fact that a document has been deposited into a court file or the fact that a person who is not a judge or a lawyer or anybody really but has just been brought into the ambit of the court through the mechanism of selecting a jury panel. Why isn't it, to make a long question short here, why shouldn't you lose because there's no exercise of judicial decision making?
Because, Your Honor, it affects, I mean, the constitutional provision is not necessarily tied to judicial decision making, although that's common in many of the cases. The selection of the pool, the veneer, that is an important to the functions of the court, and people ought to have a right to know how that is done and what the results of that are. These documents are maintained by the court, they're solicited by the court, they're used by the court in determining who's going to be a potential juror.
But you're not seeking these documents necessarily for the purposes of accountability, and I'm sympathetic to that argument in terms of accountability of the arbiter of the process of selecting the veneer. You're seeking it for yet another purpose.
Well,
and let me just, and I think we could talk about that for quite some time and not get anywhere. But there's another constitutional principle at issue here, and it's separation of powers. And that's inherent in the structure of the court rule and in the discussions by the Supreme Court, particularly in Nass versus Michaels, where they remind everybody that we're different. We don't belong under the auspices or under the prescriptions of the Public Disclosure Act. We're different. Now, the why of the difference has to do with a judge, and these all things are all connected, interestingly enough, that the ability of a person to seek supervision from a judge in terms of the particulars at issue. But you have to, under the separation of powers doctrine, allow the legislature to do its job. And if it holds hearings and makes its fact findings, as it's presumed to have done here, and says this information will not be used for any other purpose, then all we can do as judges is say, okay, the legislature has acted. And it doesn't say anything about court proceedings, because that's not what the legislature is talking about. It's talking about the information. And I don't know the answer to this one. It's a fascinating tension, but it is constitutional.
But my answer to that, Your Honor, is that the legislature did not say you cannot disclose this information to the public. They could have done that. They could have made that very clear. Didn't do that. And the court will mimic.
Is that using the document for another purpose?
It's not. The court isn't using the document at all.
Well, it doesn't say the court doesn't. It's an absolute, not to be used for any other purpose.
Well, Your Honor, I would say that the statute ought to be interpreted in light of the constitutional provision, and the absence of clear language prohibiting disclosure should indicate that it is open.
Thank you.
Well, we're glad we cleared that up.
Thank you. I think maybe after four cases, the court will take a brief recess. The case that we're going to take up next is Gallegos versus Freeman. So if the parties for that case would please be ready, we'll be back very shortly. Court will be at recess.
All rise. Court is in recess.